This podcast presents an overview of Kurdish forced migration in Turkey, with a particular focus on the forced migration of Kurds in the 1990s. This work also covers the issue of Kurdish identity in the Turkish state. Professor Joost Jongerden, Wageningen University, Netherlands.
In order to understand why the Kurdistan region in Turkey is a problematic region, we need to look at the logic of Turkish nationalism. No region is problematic in itself. It becomes problematic in political discourses. Turkey is a remain of the Ottoman Empire, in a way. And when Turkey was established, it was established on the idea of nationalism. It was modeled by the idea of nationalism, a political concept which holds that the borders of political units, the state, and cultural units, a nation, should coincide. It teaches that the power of a state depends on the degree to which its subjects respond to the idea of a particular cultural identity. An identity that is thought to characterize the nation. Since borders of states rarely correspond with those of cultural units, states or nationalist states can do two things. They can try to cleanse the population. We have seen, for example, and this is only one example, a population exchange between Greece and Turkey, a population exchange which was meant to bring a so-called logic to the map, to expel Greeks or allege Greeks from Turkey and to expel Turks from Greek, and so to, well, establish political units which were thought to be more ethnically or culturally homogeneous. The second thing states can do is to apply a policy of assimilation. And this is what the Turkish state did in the Kurdistan region of Turkey. A policy of assimilation, which was very severe, which was very strict, which repressed any or every expression of a Kurdish identity, which banned the language, and which at the same time was severely contested, or which was contested. And as a result of the contestation of this policy, of course, the region itself, the territory, became contested too. And what we have seen in the 1970s and 1980s with the emergence of the PKK, that the struggle for Kurdish rights became a struggle for Kurdish national rights, for a independent Kurdistan, for independence of the Kurdistan region in the Middle East, not only in Turkey, but also in Iraq and Syria and Iran. So in this way, we can say that the region, the Kurdistan region, not only in Turkey, but in the Middle East, is a contested territory.
Dr. David Kuthel, the Institute of Turkish Studies, Georgetown University, Washington.
What Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and his group inherited was the, just, you know, the territorial remnants of an empire, and they needed to create a national identity. It's not unusual. National identities concoct all sorts of strange notions and make up their own stories and the like. And you know, one of the problems that most national movements have is that they need to rewrite history to make people look as if they're all, you know, uniform. And I think this just ties itself back to the basic needs of you know, forming a nation. And it's the same with, you know, maybe it's the same with the UK. It's the same with the United States, and it takes slightly different forms. But, you know, the idea in Turkey was that they were all Turks, and that they came up with weird and wonderful ideas about how, in fact, these ethnicities weren't anything other than things like Mountain Turks and the like. Clearly, they had the Armenian issue to contend with, but most of the Armenians were gone. They had the Greek issue, but most of the Greeks were gone. But the Kurds, who constitute a very substantial portion of the population, and no one's ever really, you know, people give a range. And, you know, even that range might not really be useful because people intermarry. But historically, the southeast and good portions of the east have been areas where large numbers of Kurds have lived.
One has to realize that martial law and a state of emergency have ruled the Kurdish region in Turkey almost continuously since 1928. Before 1965, it was even a military zone forbidden for foreigners. And until 1978, it has been ruled under a rule of exception. In 1980, we've seen Turkey military coup, in which the whole region, or whole Turkey, came under control of the military, in which military rule was established in Turkey as a whole, not only the Kurdistan area. When in 1983 the military stepped back, we see again that in the Kurdish region in Turkey a state of exception is implemented. And this state of exception is only lifted in 2002. So from 1928 up to today, we have seen that the Turkish state has ruled the Kurdish region under a state of emergency until 2002. And only since the last 5-6 years we have seen a lifting of this state of emergency legislation in the area. When we look more specifically to the situation since the 1990s, we have seen that the situation has gone from bad to worse. In the early 1990s, we see that the conflict between the state of Turkey and the Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, began to take many lives. Reliable statistics are not available, but the conflict may have caused as many as 35,000-40,000 deaths. An estimated 1 to 3 million people were displaced when Turkey's security forces systematically evacuated, destroyed, burned around 3,000 rural settlements. And when we look to statements of international human rights organizations, among others Amnesty International, they conclude that at the beginning of the 1990s, a new phase in repression has begun. And repression has long been the response to problems in Turkey, has long been the response to deal with the Kurdish issue. But at the beginning of the 1990s, we see that a full-scale dirty war started. A dirty war with many extrajudicial executions, with the evacuation, burning of villages, the evictions of villages, and as a result, the death of many people.
We chahe hoten askeri bolo kainseri hoten tevi askeri Diyarbakir va khaniye
matef. We were in our village. Soldiers from Diyarbakir came and burnt down our houses. A high-ranking soldier asked us to leave and evacuate the village in a week. He threatened us with burning down the few houses left, if anyone was left in the village. So we had no choice but to leave. I hired transport for our belongings to move to Diyarbakir. That's how it was. We rented a place to start with, then we got our own place. Thankfully, we had some money and a herd. We sold our herd and bought our own place. We worked and are still working. We live from one day to another. We are surviving. Our only trouble is we want to go home. We want to go back to our village, to our homeland. It's where our fathers and grandparents are from. Even if it was as small as the size of a stone, it is still sweet to us, because it is our homeland. There is a saying on how sweet our home is in our language. We have been brought up in the country. For someone who grew up in the country, city life can be difficult and life can be cut in half. This is because air in the country is fresher. Life is nicer than here. We didn't have a choice. We have been forced to leave our homes. I want to say one more thing. 50 men have disappeared from our area and we haven't heard from them for 15 years now. It is said that they were taken away by the state. We are free to work even in government offices, but if the state finds out about someone's political involvement, then they would detain them. I haven't had any problems with the state, personally, to be honest, for the last 15 years. I know it's happening to many other people, my neighbours and other people, I know, but not to me. It is due to their political involvements, but also our crime is being Kurdish. But this is not something anyone can change. We are born as Kurdish. It is our mother tongue. We have not asked them not to speak their mother tongue. It would not be a reasonable thing to do. But they are doing it to us. There is no democracy in Turkey. Turkey is anti-democratic. It has got better. We used to be a lot more fearful. We used to be frightened at night and wait in fear in our homes in case it was our turn to be taken away. I want to say something. Whatever difficulties and oppressions we suffer can be resolved immediately over 24 hours by European and American governments. Our faith is in your hands. They claimed that terrorists were coming to our village and we looked after them. Who they call terrorists to us are guerrillas, and they are part of us. They were saying that we were giving them food and shelter. Of course, I gave them bread. Because of that, they burnt down our homes. And they also said, you have to leave this land. Mustafa Gundogdu, Kurdish Human Rights Project, London.
The situation of the IDPs in Turkey is a disastrous situation. It's a huge problem. It's a big problem that has to be addressed in different ways, economical, social, political ways. And it hasn't been addressed. So there's a wider Kurdish community in Europe. It's about over 2 million people living in Europe, in exile. And some of them are IDPs. Basically, IDP issue in Turkey also feeds the migration to Europe, because these people, they have no options to set up a new life in the big cities. So they try to look for options to leave the country and go in better conditions, live in another country. There are a lot of stories, of course, that even one of the IDP organizations in Turkey published a book about the stories of the displacement. People were talking how displacement of their village has started, you know. But most of the stories comes from the pressure from the Turkish security forces coming and visiting villages and saying them to accept to be village guards, the paramilitary groups working with the state. If they don't accept it, then they have to leave the village or hamlet, wherever they live. Most of the people didn't accept it, because it means that if you become a village guard, you're an armed guy, you're arm given by the state, and you have to fight against the Kurdish guerrilla groups in the region. most of the families have, some families have their children involved in this movement. Some people, they don't want to take part of this military activity because they are not capable of doing it, and they don't want to risk their lives because there might be attack on them because they are taking government's gun against a movement active in the region. Most of the stories become, it's a part of that one, to people who didn't accept the village guards system. They were forced out of their villages. People that government or military would believe they are helping and harboring the organization in the region were also warned and displaced from the region, from their villages. The second phase of the activity is, I think the most of the story were like military goes to the village and ask them to leave the village in a certain time. If they don't leave, and most of the time people cannot because they don't have any options and nobody giving them compensation or revenues to move and go somewhere else, and nobody showing them another house to leave. So people staying there, and the military comes again and forcibly evicted the village and then burned down the village in order to secure that they are not going to come back and live in the same village after a while. So there are a lot of villages which is basically destroyed to the ground and are not able to be used by the people. These villages has to be rebuilt. The economy in the region is totally destroyed. Farming, the main economical activities these people could do, they are not able to do that one because there's no way they can use their fields, and fields are left for a long time unused, and etc. So there are a lot of tragic stories that we know. People were, animals were killed, and people were killed because they refused to leave the villages. Elderly people, they didn't want to leave. When I was in Turkey in mid 90s, I was working with a group of people on force IDPs in Turkey in the big cities, and impact on them, psychological and social impacts on them. And I found that a lot of disturbing stories. I mean, we were not able to continue interviews with the people because it was too hard to really listen to the stories, that it was full of cruelties and bad things, basically. So it was also, in a way, it was a very bad things to make people to remember these things. And so we were not able to continue interviews even.
İstanbul'a gelme sebebimiz işte Diyarbakır'da Lice köyü, hatta Lice'nin köyüne bağlı Çavundur. Çavundur köyü tam olarak.
We came to Istanbul in 1995. I came from a small village near Diyarbakır. The reason we emigrated to Istanbul is that the state burnt down our houses in our village. Although the government officially claimed that it was done by the terrorists, it was actually done by the state. In fact, it was forced migration as a result of the government policy. It has been 13 years since we emigrated. I'm staying with my family.
İşte kaç sene oldu? 13 senedir buradayız. Ailemle beraber kalıyorum zaten. Ne diyeyim başka ki?
I was 10 years old. We had difficulties in adapting to life here. I still have difficulties. Do I want to go back? Yes. In fact, I do. But I also know that the living conditions are not safe there. If the living conditions are improved and made possible for us to live there, then I would like to go back. First of all, I experienced major difficulties at school because I didn't speak Turkish fluently. I had difficulty understanding other students. I felt humiliated and oppressed by this. I couldn't openly say I was Kurdish. I don't remember disclosing my Kurdish identity when I first arrived. I think for the first 5 years, I never told anyone that I was Kurdish. Actually, I remember saying I wasn't Kurdish. I would say, "My father is Kurdish, but I am not. We come from Diyarbakir." Basically, I sort of adapted to the system. Nobody told me to say that in my family. It was just me. All my friends were Turkish. They were born and brought up in Istanbul. I wanted to be like them and not be different in any way. There wasn't any other reason. I became politically aware of my national identity during my secondary education. Only then I started freely saying I am Kurdish, and I still do. I don't know how to describe other difficulties of living here. I'll tell you about an argument on a bus. It happened a few years ago. I was with a couple of friends talking in the Kurdish dialect of Zaza on a bus journey in the city. A man who had just finished his army duty but still in uniform interrupted our conversation and asked, "Why do you speak in the Zaza language? Why do you not speak Turkish?" Our reply was, "It is our mother tongue." His response to this was, "If you are living in Turkey, you have to speak only in Turkish, and your religion has to be Islam." We said, "We are Kurdish, and we will talk Kurdish whenever we want, and continue speaking in Kurdish." But other people on the bus also started murmuring disapprovingly. We got frightened that we might get lynched by the people on the bus. Thankfully, the man got off the bus soon after that. So that was something that happened to me.
The Turkish state does not recognize a Kurdish identity. A citizen of the Turkish state is supposed to be a Turk. It's as simple as that. In fact, it's also mentioned in the constitution of the Republic of Turkey, already in the constitution of 1924, but also in the new constitution, which has been drafted or has been written by the military after their coup in 1980. Recently, we have seen a discussion on the concept of citizenship in the constitution. There was some talk about drafting a new constitution in which citizenship will not be equated with Turkishness or with being a Turk. At least this was one of the discussions when there was a talk or a brief discussion about a new constitution. But over the last months, due to all different political problems in Turkey, I think this has dropped from the agenda. So what we can say is that not only since the 1990s, but from the establishment of the Republic of Turkey, citizenship is equated with Turkishness. And in fact, the Kurds in Turkey has become some kind of non-entities.
If you look at Turks today, there are huge numbers of Turks who are really Circassian by origin, Abkhaz by origin, from the Balkans, from all over. Turkey's a nation of immigrants as much as the United States is. And so I think in order to rally people around a single flag, a single ideology and all that stuff, they tried to squash any potential divisive elements and the idea of a separate Kurdish population with its own history and language and culture and stuff like that was something that constituted a real threat. Now, in reality, I think that Kurds and Turks have gotten along and lived side by side for a long time. There's been frictions, and there is a separate Kurdish language, two of them there. So the Mountain Turks thing, I think, is derived from an effort to play down the fact that they are ethnically Kurdish. Today, the top-down reforms, fortunately, are lifting. There isn't the need for it. And I think people are more comfortable with the notion of their ancestral heritage. The United States went through a huge period in the late 60s, early 70s, more than the 70s, where all of a sudden we discovered that we were Italian-Americans or Afro-Americans or, you fill in the blank, Scots-Americans, and I don't think that this is anything a whole lot more. It can take on political ramifications, and it did during the time of the PKK. And they used that the same way that, you know, some of the radical black groups in the 60s may have highlighted their separateness from American culture, Afro-American culture, some of the, you know, these were fringe groups. PKK is a fringe group, and PKK obviously has territorial desires, and it's not something that's shared by the vast majority of people living within the borders.
Jubilee seme, ama demek ya durda hatim diver demek kom dibistan
ile. I am from Bitlis. I came here a long time ago. As soon as I finished school, I wanted to engage in an active political movement because the Kurdish question was occupying my mind a lot and I was discovering my Kurdish identity. I thought, yes, I am Kurdish. We have our own language, but our roots were deeply seated in history with never-ending persecutions and oppressions. I was also most affected by my brother, who was murdered by the state because of his political views. I've never forgot when I was in my first year in primary school, we had a Turkish teacher from Erzincan who launched a campaign against anyone who spoke Kurdish. He forbid Kurdish altogether. However, students' mothers did not know any Turkish, and after school we were not able to speak Turkish with our mothers. I remember being very angry and cross with the teacher for this. In retaliation, I launched a campaign that no one should speak Turkish at school. As a result, I was expelled from school. After this event, I was punished and was not allowed to study at the same school. I had to go to another school to continue my studies.
همی به ترکی باخوین کمپانیوی آهو اما دایی که وان
After my brother had been murdered, I got involved in active politics and political movements. So I continued my studies in Turkish until my first year in secondary education. I started in Istanbul, in Princess Islands. I have got responsibility for my family. I got arrested twice, which contributed to my political development. I got arrested first time around when we organized a demonstration to protest of the genocide in Halepsi. I got blacklisted by the police thereafter. I was detained for 9 days during this time. I was subjected to various torture. I was given electric shocks and then being crucified on a cross similar to what we call Palestinian crucifixion. It was very painful. At some point, I thought I wouldn't survive it. Following the detention, I was persecuted on the basis that I was a member of the PKK. I was released 9 days later. This is how the Kurdish political struggle is in Turkey. For some of us, it is detention. For others, getting killed. What I've been through is part of what we Kurds are subject to. It is very tragic. The Kurdish political struggle is full of obstacles and difficulties. Kurds who fled from oppression really struggled to survive here like us. We didn't evacuate our villages straight away. First, we partly moved to the town. We only moved everything to town when my brother was killed. The state's oppression on Kurds is still continuing. I continued my political activities in Halep. I don't think leaving our homes and moving to big cities is a solution to the Kurdish question. The problem of where to live in order to escape state oppression is a question on each and every Kurdish person's mind. The Kurdish question has got to be solved. Unless it is resolved in some way, no one will be completely free from oppression, whether in cities or in our homeland. There has been a lot of efforts made towards a solution. There are projects on how to go about it. We would like to live in Kurdistan, given the right conditions, obviously.
Kapat kirin, digirtin yani, digirtin. av le jure da her evaki av dhat ve
the course of the mass migration has been a change in the war strategy of the Turkish armed forces as a way to deal or try to deal with the threat posed by the PKK. One has to bear in mind that in the beginning of the 1990s, the PKK was very strong in the Kurdish areas in Turkey, and that they controlled large parts of the territory. Not the cities, but most of the rural areas were controlled by the PKK. The strategy of the army at the until the beginning of the 1990s, one may say 1991, 1992, was to defend the large towns, the cities, to build garnisons and defend these garnisons or to use them for sweep and destroy operations. The result of this more or less defensive war strategy was that it created room for maneuver for the PKK. And as a result, a dominant position, a very strong position in the Kurdish areas. And in 1991, 1992, we see that the Turkish army is implementing a new war strategy. And it's a strategy of clear and hold, a strategy of getting dominance in the rural areas. And as a result of this, or one of the expressions, one of the constituencies of this new war strategy has been that everything what could give hiding or support to the PKK was destroyed. The villages and the inhabitants had furnished the PKK with monetary resources raised through taxation, maybe forced taxation, as well as shelter, recruits, logistics and intelligence up to the 1990s. The forest in the immediate surroundings of the settlements, if there were forests of course, provided the PKK with cover and hideout. And the new strategy of the Turkish army requires first and foremost that these areas be cleared of whomever or whatever might offer support and assistance to the PKK. Villages became the targets of evacuation and burning before 1991. However, at the time of the army had thought of these actions solely as a means of reprisal for elite support of the PKK. After the implementation of the new war strategy in 92, village evacuations and burning of buildings and crops and forest started to become a structural element of the military strategy. As a result of that, we see, especially from 1992, 1993, 1994, maybe the most severe years of the most bad years of village destruction, village evacuations, that thousands of small settlements, small rural settlements, villages have become evacuated with a result of a massive migration from the countryside to cities. Cities in the region itself, for example Diyarbakir, but also and maybe more to cities more in the west of Turkey, Adana, Istanbul, and others. So we can say that the cause of the mass migration of Kurds in the 1990s, the beginning of the 1990s, from the beginning of the 1990s, is caused by a new warring strategy of the Turkish army, which directly targeted the countryside, the rural areas, and evacuated, burned thousands of villages, rural settlements. The problems which arose from these forced evictions, from this forced migration, has been neglected, politically neglected, for many, many, many years. It's only that since 2006, I think, a compensation measure has been adopted in Turkey, the possibility to get compensation for losses inflicted. But the conditions for getting compensation are very difficult, and the calculation on how much compensation you are entitled to is rather complicated and much disputed. I have no exact numbers, but the compensation law has been severely criticized of being, well, one may say, too little and also too late.
According to figures, about less than 1 million people have applied for this compensation law. But if you look for the figures, that amount of the people basically affected by the conflict is a huge amount of people, almost more than 3 million people were IDPs anyway. There are also people tortured, people taken arbitrary detention, people were killed, extrajudicial killings. And if you make a complex picture of the situation, that you cannot really see that many Kurds hasn't been affected by the situation. So basically a lot of Kurds, millions of Kurds, has been a victim of this situation. We have sent number of delegations, fact-finding missions, to the region in order to investigate whether this compensation commission is something that people on the ground can really easily use it, or is it something that cosmetic, that Turkey has done it in order to secure their negotiations, EU membership negotiations with the EU. The information we have that this has the compensation law has been recommended by the EU bodies to Turkey in order to make Turkey's accession process smooth in terms of a huge IDP problem, because they were mentioning in their annual reports, assessment reports, or in reports on Turkey or negotiation papers, that this is a huge issue and Turkey has to address, and so far Turkey hasn't been able to address the issue. We have investigated the issue, we have met with the civil society groups, bar associations, human rights groups, organizations working on IDPs, women rights groups, to see whether these compensation law commissions are fair and enough to compensate these people, and the response wasn't the positive one, basically, because the compensation commission is led by government officials, although there are some people from the civil society groups, bar associations are involved, but these commissions are not substantially enough to meet people's needs in the region.
These type of things, inevitably, when you get radicalized members with arms, are going to require a counter measure through either police or the military. And the police were totally overwhelmed in that area. The military was probably the only competent organization. But as we all should know by now, U.S., Britain, Turkey, China, there's a difference between military and police. And you always want the police to be in there because they don't function the same way the military does. But during that period, when they had set up their own courts, where they had de facto ownership of the countryside, especially after dark, where they were killing whoever took the government, the Ankara government line, there really wasn't any choice. And, I think that this is something that we've sort of, there's an irony in that, separatism in Turkey is somehow chic, but separatism in Northern Ireland is not. Separatism, if it crops up its head in this country, God forbid, I mean, we might use nuclear weapons. The nation states react very poorly to, unless perhaps you're Belgian, to the notion that you're going to split apart. And when you also, you know, introduce elements of wide-scale assassination, murder, coercion, the like. You know, Turkey went through way too difficult a series of birth pains to turn around and voluntarily let pieces get peeled off.
When it comes to the statistics on evacuation, numbers are contested, and human rights organizations give very different statistics than, for example, the Turkish state. So the quantitative aspect of displacement are controversial. According to government figures, only 350,000 people has been forced displaced in the war against the PKK. Human rights organization claim that the number is up to 3 to maybe 4 million of people evacuated from their villages, from their rural settlements. When we look to surveys, both official and non-official figures indicate that some 93% of the displaced population wish to return to their villages. But of course it makes a very vast difference if this percentage is 93% of 400,000 people or 93% of 4 million people. Statistics of return are not very reliable, and the numbers are not only not very reliable, they are also contradictory. So it's very difficult to give an estimation of return. For example, in 1999, that's almost 9 years ago, it was said that about 34,000 people had returned. In 2001, authorities claimed that 18,000 people had returned. So in 2001, the number of return was lower than in 1999, when one expects that over the years the number of return would have increased. In 2002, again, the number was, according to official figures, 30,000. So then again, it was on the level of 1999. The problem is the figures, that it's not clear how the number has been calculated, and the figures are never accompanied with clear indications about who and where people went to. So it's just a number without any foundation. So it's very difficult to check also the reliability of return figures. But what is important is that Turkey does not have a clear return policy. It has on paper. On paper there is a village return policy, but the policy is not implemented. More than that, at the ground there are many obstacles to return. In the region, still village guard militias are in function, and many of the returnees or potential returnees have indicated that they fear repercussions by village guards, by the village guards militia. There are also obstacles from the authorities, from the military, from the gendarmerie in the region. So no clear return policy in combination with many obstacles on the ground makes it for people very difficult, also possibly dangerous, to return. So it's very likely that the number of returnees is also very low. But again, exact statistics are lacking, and it's also not possible for civil society organizations or for human rights organizations or for NGOs to try to get reliable statistics. Permission for producing reliable statistics on return have been obstructed, have been forbidden by the Turkish authorities in the past. So it's very difficult to get a reliable picture on return.
The thing that the Turkish government has to do over time is like any government, is to build confidence. And, you know, clearly they are in a period where confidence is being built. It is not something that, you know, the way the Turkish government translates to, you know, the man on the street in a small eastern village or town may not be the same it translates in western Turkey. They have a long ways to go, but they are moving in that direction. I mean, there's just no question that they're moving in that direction. You know, it is all about, again, it's also about shifting from military to policing. And once you get local police, once you get that, you know, and it begins at the political level as well. This government, the AKP, has done very well being down there and coordinating and presenting a different face. This was one of the singular failures of earlier political groups was the parties, and it's not one particular party, but they simply could not provide a credible case for local people having their issues being addressed and feeding its way back up to the center. It's a lot better now. Does it have a long ways to go? Yeah, sure. And also keep in mind that, you know, there is a economic component here. I mean, this is the poorest area of the country. Poverty counts for a lot, at least in my book. I think if you go into most places, you will find that the root source of many social frictions is poverty. You know, religion will count for a lot, but if you cannot feed your children, if you cannot find employment, this is something that's going to alienate a lot of people. It's a vicious circle, obviously. You know, you get poverty in areas where there is, you know, low political enfranchisement and economic development. But, you know, you're not going to put economic resources into areas, or private sector resources aren't going to come into areas where there's, you know, violence that goes with the poverty. And, you know, so breaking that cycle is something that, you know, the Turks are doing a pretty good job at. It's not perfect again, but, you know, there is progress.
If it comes to internal agencies and governments reacting to this migration, one may say that the issue of forced displacement in Turkey, the forced displacement of Kurds in Turkey, have been ignored at large. No international NGO, no international agency, no government has been seriously addressed the problem of forced migration in Turkey. Even though Turkey may have had the largest, or a very large displaced population, also when you compare it on an international scale, the displacement which occurred in Turkey is one of the major displacements in the world in the 1990s, one of the major displacements, forced displacements of people. In spite of that, international agencies, international NGOs, government, European Union, largely ignored the issue. And this is probably, or most likely, politically motivated. Turkey is a very strong ally in the NATO. It's a country which is seen as a ally of the West. One may say that the world has been divided in the good guys and the bad guys, and since Turkey is among the good guys, the problem which has been created in the backyard of the good guy has been neglected at large. And of course, Turkey does not want to have anyone looking at its internal problems. But the international agencies and NGOs did not put much effort in it, in getting the problem dealt with.